Right now it is time for the Media Beat with David Tarachuk. David joins us on a Friday morning. We take a look at the media coverage around the United States and around the world, as a matter of fact. David has his own website, themediabeat.us. He's also a PBS television correspondent, reports on ethics and belief, and we are always pleased to have him in here on a Friday morning. Good morning, David.
Hello there. I'm glad to be joining the ever sagacious Marshall Miles as I report in from the media capital of the world, New York City. In fact, I have media news, actual media news to start with. Big media, as is often known nowadays, will of course, we expect it to carry the news, but this week big media is the news. Government lawyers, the Federal Justice Department, plus eight state attorneys general, are taking Google, maybe the biggest of big media, to court, and not for the first time. Google's already facing four other government lawsuits. The current case is a massive antitrust suit that accuses Google of using its monopolist position to dictate the rules of the marketplace for online advertisements. The company basically controls this specialized market in which online ads are bought and sold, and Google's in the happy position of getting a reported 32% profit on every deal that it makes happen in that market. The best journalistic shorthand I've seen in the coverage to describe what Google is accused of is that we should imagine that the Goldman Sachs investment company, for instance, is actually in charge themselves of the entire New York Stock Exchange. That's the kind of power that Google is seen to have now. So that's going to be an interesting fight between the government and Google.
You know what's interesting about that fight, it's a big if, because you just don't know about how well the government's going to present their case. If the government wins, it sets a benchmark where now the other big mega online sources can also be sued and brought into line.
Absolutely. Yeah, this will be a precedent-making judgment when it comes, if ever there was one. Facebook, for instance, and Amazon, which is a mill of advertising as well as sales. All the big boys in this game will be affected by the outcome of this case. I also want to hear our familiar fanfare. I've got some journalistic work that I really do want to fanfare this week.
All right, well, let's see if I can get it right here this week.
We didn't get it right last time, did we? Well, let's try it a little harder. There we go.
All right, there you go, David.
Good. Good raucous fanfare for this week, an investigative journalist called Dina Temple Raston, probably a familiar name to listeners. She used to work for NPR News, but like increasing numbers of NPR people, she's now producing her own podcast. It's called Click Here, and as the name suggests, she concentrates on information technology matters. Her recent work that's earning our fanfare commendation is published at a very timely moment. Today, Friday, is the last day of a big convention in Las Vegas, where so many conventions happen for some reason. It's dedicated to what it calls law enforcement training and education. But its actual name indicates something a little more specific. It's actually called TaserCon, and behind the convention is the technology and weapons company Axon, based in Arizona, the company that invented and marketed to law enforcement organizations right across America the Taser, that famous or infamous electroshock treatment. It's a weapon. It's a weapon product. That's what the company calls it, a weapon product. Deborah Raston has produced a revealing report about the company. Axon has been developing a clever way of combining the taser with the drone, so producing a flying machine that can disable you if the flyer of the machine wants you disabled. It's an alarming kind of thought, you might think. And so thought the company itself, appropriately enough. They'd asked its ethics board. Yes, the company has an ethics board, thankfully, which decided after taking a long year of careful study of this whole subject that a flying machine that delivers electroshocks is not such a great idea. This is what Temple Reston has discovered. The company was, as she discovered through obtaining internal company documents, the company has decided otherwise. It's disagreeing with its own ethics board. And it's going ahead with the development. In her reporting, she naturally enough canvassed his opinion among law enforcement people and civil liberties people and highlights the concerns they have, especially when the role of this drone would use artificial intelligence. Of course it would, wouldn't it? In a way that the video-equipped and facial recognition-equipped drones plus tasers would be working, the company was, she's suggesting, influenced in its eagerness to develop the new weapon by the troubling experience of the Uvalde school shooting, where law enforcement supposedly found it difficult to get near the shooter for a long time. We'll remember that. A flying taser might have been helpful there. But other people recall a very different Texas horror. Dallas in 2016, not so prominently reported an event, when a robot was used during a standoff with a man who was suspected of killing police officers. The robot blew him up. It was not a good precedent, you might say. But in this current development, the company Axon told Temple Reston in a statement that taser drones in schools, flying taser drones in schools is an idea, not a product. That's the direct quotation, and it's a long way off. On the other hand, it's still in development, and even though the ethics board reported against it, the company still thinks it's something that they should be developing and offering. Schools across the country seem to be in their mind. It's a disturbing story, and it's very well reported by Dino Temple Raston.
That is a disturbing story because it brings you back to science fiction movies where you just wouldn't think that it's possible, but it is possible. You know, I woke up this morning, David, and this is going to go local or international. And one of my acquaintances on Facebook posted that her son died yesterday. Her son, it was down south, and he was shot by officers. I haven't seen the total news story yet. He did have a gun in his hand. But he was 75 rounds, was the count. And like I said, I'm not making any judgment against police or whatever, because I don't know the total situation. But it brings me back to New York City many years ago with that poor taxi cab driver, where he had a hail of bullets, which killed him. And out of either 25 or 30 shots, only two or three hit the target. This is just a frightening story when you hear it, because also today we will see the video in the death of the 29-year-old who was killed by police. And they're warning people
in Memphis, yeah. Tyre Nichols, yes.
And they're warning
in which five police officers are charged with his killing.
Yeah.
Yes, the video is supposed to be reported to be given out to the in public later today.
And so that was the way I started off my day, and I said to myself, "Gosh, you know, like I said, 75 shots to take down one person seems like an awful lot."
There's a link in a sense to the. To the taser, flying taser thing, and that you know, our law enforcement agencies are relying so much on technology and, in a sense, an extraordinary militarization of police work. now, and the fact that that weaponry should be employed with such recklessness, just apparent recklessness in the case that you're mentioning, is a horrible accompaniment to the very evidence. And this is how it was described by the authorities in Memphis, the brutality with which Tyre Nichols was attacked and then ultimately died. there's something about both the ethos of many police forces and the fact that they have such extraordinarily powerful armaments at their disposal. A fully automatic gun which fires off so many rounds so fast will inevitably result in extraordinary shot counts like that. 75 bullets going off in the space of less than a minute in the case of a submachine or a full machine gun fire is the sort of rate we can expect. The way that the many American police forces are getting militarized, it's very disturbing. And of course, we can expect, unfortunately, a lot of shocked reaction to when we see the reality of this video, which apparently will be made up of sequences from police individual body cams worn by officers, and also the security cameras from the surrounding area. And there's an attempt to prepare the populace for the brutality that was going to be seen so clearly tonight. And at the same time, from the family of Mr. Nichols himself, a FedEx employee, by the way, and an avid skateboarder, his family are appealing for people's reaction to be temperate. People need to protest. Clearly, it's an unacceptable situation, and people will want to protest against it. But the family want people to protest peacefully. It's a horrible case, a sad case, and it's important, I guess, this time around, as so many other times around, that people bear in mind the wider importance of. Of not getting the situation complicated by popular, that's not the right word for it, is it? But mass response of a violent kind. We don't want this brutality to be reflected again in any kind of mass brutality or mass brutal reaction to it. I think everyone's on tenterhooks in Memphis over it, so we need to watch that very carefully.
And what this particular incident shows is this isn't necessarily white officers against black civilians. This shows that potentially these are black officers that are being charged. The problematic of I'll use a word that's horrible, but it's true, quote, trigger happy, end quote. That's the problem, and by no means does it represent a majority of police, but it doesn't have to. When something like this happens, it really has to be brought to the forefront, and it has to be. There is no blue line here when it comes to something like this.
No, it's as I say, it's you can see it as an instance of the militarization of our police forces. It's a fair question to ask. Would it have, we know about the institutionalized racism that is endemic to so many police forces. It's a fair question to ask. Would it have happened if the man who was the police pounced upon had been white? Would it have happened? An open question. It's still one element of this very hot let's put it as simply as that.
All right. Yeah, it's going to be a shocking story when it comes out today. Moving on and taking a look at other things. Once again, I want to go to the Ukraine because their president did a very smart political thing, which is shake up his government because of corruption. And with all the money that is coming into the Ukraine and equipment, it was a very wise thing for an otherwise very busy president dealing with a war to bring this to the forefront and try to bring an end to what has been one of the major problems internally in the Ukraine for many, many years.
Indeed, yes. And in some ways, it was part and parcel of the situation in which back as far as 2014 when Russia made its first military venture against Russia and essentially annexed first invaded and then later on annexed the Crimea region of what was then still Ukraine. In amongst all that was the very strong sense that Ukraine, just as much as Russia itself and other countries in that same region, are prone to the most extraordinary kind of kleptocracy. People in positions of authority and responsibility and power have been making enormous amounts of money. With abandon, but that's not the right word. But certainly rampant, and it has sort of faded out of the picture as people concentrated on the fact that Ukraine was at war, defending itself. But of course, it went on pretty well unchecked, but sensibly enough, as you say. President Zelensky is seeing the need to crack down, especially in view of the swath of financial and technological and hardware support that Western nations are now increasingly sending his way. Major changes just happened in this last week with both Germany and the United States for the first time ramping up their military support to include actual combat tanks, the Abrams M1 tanks from America, and although that'll be rather slow in delivery, and also Germany's very efficient battle tanks that are coming initially from other countries that Germany already sold them to, like Poland, for instance. But Germany itself will be sending some directly too, as expected. So all that new support, expensive, and it brings with it, of course, a lot of money for training and supplies of other kinds. There's a lot of opportunity once more for corruption, and Zelensky, wisely enough, sees the need to reassure the West that it's all going to be handled the right way, and people won't be skimming off the kind of payoffs and back, you know, back payments that off the books payments that have been a feature of life and in a sort of shadow economy of Ukraine. I don't suppose he's going to clean it up entirely. Let's hope that he makes considerable improvements, however.
Now let's come back to the United States. What's going on? First, of course, President Trump taking the secret documents and taking them to his Mar-a-Lago resort, leaving them basically out in public areas. Then, of course, it came to light. President Biden, his vice presidential documents were found in secure places, but still found on his property. And then we go down to Mike Pence, where secure documents were found there. This is a story that I just don't know. We haven't heard about President Obama yet, or you know, how far is this going?
Well, you know, we had also the president, the previous Secretary of State, operated in a somewhat lax way with documents, especially in the electronic field. The famous emails of Hillary Clinton. It's not unknown for very senior American politicians to be somewhat lax with their keeping of secure communications. So, you know, we should not be surprised, I suppose. But of course, maybe this is only a perception and is not the total truth, but one observation that's being made at the moment is that our current president, talking about the time when he was vice president, and indeed the other recent vice president, Mike Pence, both seem to be willing to take responsibility in this matter, and also probably, this is a speculation, ended up you know, being loose with these documents out of simple human carelessness, and that's one approach to this whole matter. While on the other hand, by complete contrast, former President Trump was actively in a kind of battle against authority about the proper way to handle these documents. He has not cooperated with the investigation into the documents, you know, in complete contrast to both Pence and Biden, who are happily, well, probably not very happily, but are fully, it is said, cooperating with the investigation. And the inevitable conclusion to draw from that, and it's being drawn, is that one cases or two cases were ones of just carelessness, and the other one was a case of devious, if not entirely explicable, design. Trump clearly wanted those documents out of the White House and in his own possession. The other ones look more like just a kind of massive case of, oops, didn't mean to do that.
And once again, I didn't want this to slide by without talking about it, and that is the violence that has erupted once again on the Gaza with Israel, and the battle. The battle goes on there, and it just doesn't seem to ever go away.
No, absolutely. I think it's really important to take full notice of that. There's been a really loud warning sound coming out of Israeli-occupied West Bank this week. We saw the most deadly Israeli raid into the Jenin refugee camp in nearly two decades. Nine Palestinians killed when troops evidently encircled buildings in a storm of gunfire and grenades and tear gas. In this incredibly overcrowded refugee camp, Palestinian officials say two of the dead were civilians, including a 61-year-old woman. It has to be recognized also that militant groups are claiming the other seven victims as members of their organizations. The Israeli military says its troops went in to arrest Islamic Jihad militants, who were planning what it called major attacks. Now, history matters here, a history that may not be clear to everybody watching the news from afar. Israel's military raids have been mounting all the time recently, sparking increasingly fierce gunfights with what is actually a whole new generation of armed Palestinians. And for anyone with experience of this dispute, this current attack must prompt comparisons with April 2002, which is the height of the Second Intifada, you must remember, the Palestinian uprising of that period. Back then, Israel launched a full-scale incursion. It became known as the Battle of Jenin, you'll remember. And in that, that led in the end to at least 52 Palestinians being killed and 23 Israeli soldiers. And now with a new Israeli hard-right coalition government recently installed under Benjamin Netanyahu, again, signs are very ominous now because of that, of this incursion, this recent one. We can expect a drastic worsening of the situation, a much wider flare-up, in other words. It's very concerning. Secretary of State Tony Blinken's going there on Monday. He says he wants to preserve the two-state approach to Arab-Israeli peace talks. Well, how can they be preserved when it's so clearly being destroyed at the moment by Israeli action? It's very. We need to watch this very carefully.
And the main thing that you pointed out was the new generation. As long as, and I'm making no judgment here with Israeli defending itself or going overboard, but you over the past 7 to 8 years, there's been no cooling off period really, where the next generation can possibly be a little less violent. That, you know, it happened in Ireland, Northern Ireland. I don't know how long it'll hold for, but you need a certain cooling off period so the generation that's coming up doesn't hold that same immense hatred.
Yeah, the turning of a screw is continuous, and that's what is so troubling. And every now and again, in fact, increasingly so. That's my point. It's not exactly unreported, but it's underappreciated, yeah. I think, how serious the conflicts are that are bubbling along without respite, as you say. There's no chance for talks of any kind to get underway again, and the chances get less and less. As these incidents, and some of them quite serious, and some of them really serious, and I think this latest one is extremely ominous indeed.
David, always great to talk with you on a Friday morning about the media. Have yourself a great weekend, and we'll speak to you next week.
Look forward to that.
David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Once again, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us, and also at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand, click on the Media Beat with David Tarachuk.